Welcome to The Point on CAI. I'm Sam Houghton. Steve Junker is out. I'm in my home in East Falmouth. It's Friday, October 23rd, and this is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Thanks for joining us this morning. Today, we'll be hearing from Noah Asimo with the Vineyard Gazette, Ethan Genter with the Cape Cod Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, George Brennan with the Martha's Vineyard Times, and CAI's Eve Zukoff and Jeanette Barnes. Later this hour, we'll hear about a toxic algae bloom becoming more problematic in local waters, and rate hikes are in store on Steamship Authority ferries. But first, the pandemic has had major implications for the arts, which makes the timing for the single largest bequest ever given to the Cape Cod Foundation all the more timely. Joining us now is Ethan Genter, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times. Hello, and thanks for joining us, Ethan.
Good morning, Sam.
So what do we know about where this money is coming from, and how will it be used?
Yeah, so this is a $6.4 million bequest. It was from a lady. Basically, all the foundation can tell us because of the terms of the bequest was a woman with longtime connections to the Cape. She had been living on the Cape at the time of her death, and she was kind of very ingrained in the arts and cultural community around here. So yeah, like you said, this is the biggest single bequest at a time when a lot of art institutions across the Cape and across the country are really hurting because of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think there was a quote in the story, something like $14 billion in losses to date in the arts, and that's nationally. What do we get a sense of where kind of this money might be going, this almost $6.5 million?
Yeah, so the biggest portion, about $4.5 million, is earmarked for an endowment for visual arts. And there's a bit of discretion on how it can be used. Then the other 1.5 is set. It's kind of an even more open-ended. It's to support community life on Cape Cod. So there is some discretion on how they can use these. There are a couple particulars. There's a $200,000 endowment to the Cape Cod Center for the Arts campus, which is kind of the Cape Playhouse. And then there's another endowment also for the Cape Cod Museum of Art to kind of help with their operating expenses. But basically, they're kind of envisioning kind of grants coming out every year, hopefully starting next year.
Mm-hmm. But a pretty substantial gift that will help, you know, a scene that's really in need.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if there would be a time more dire for a lot of places to get a kind of an injection of this money is kind of a miracle, I would say.
Yeah. Also, Ethan, the state moratorium on evictions ended on Saturday. That's been in place really since the beginning of the pandemic. The Cape was already in a housing crisis before all of this. And your reporting found that we're seeing more and more people looking for rental housing. You talked to a number of affordable housing advocates. What are they seeing?
So they're kind of seeing, so I talked to a lot of people on Monday, kind of the first business day with the moratorium was out. And basically they said there isn't a whole lot of shift yet. It's very early on. Evictions take time. There's basically a two-week requirement to give notice to a tenant that you're going to kind of start the eviction process. So they're expecting kind of within the next month or so to kind of see kind of really how this starts to play out. But basically what a lot of housing advocates I talked to said, don't wait until you're in dire need or in a crisis to ask for help. A lot of them have funds set up, give them a call, try and get some help before you are like down and out, was basically kind of the message I had got from talking to a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's renters as well as tenant housing owners, really, who are renting.
Yeah, and even foreclosures. So there is still a moratorium at the federal level that it's slightly different than what Mass had. So Mass did have a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. So foreclosures is now not part of, it's run by the CDC, the new eviction moratorium. So there are stuff, but yeah, I mean, one big worry that HAC, the Housing Assistance Corporation, has is if enough Cape landlords say, hey, this isn't really working for us, we're either not getting paid or it's too much of a hassle, they really worry that the Cape's already small housing, rental housing stock could shrink even more and create an even larger crisis, especially in the red hot real estate market that we're seeing right now.
Right. I'd imagine, you know, homeowners are saying, well, I can make a lot more money just selling my house rather than trying to rent in this market.
Yeah, or going to kind of short-term rentals once that kind of returns in more full force. But yeah, it's like you said before, the Cape was already in a housing crisis to start. And so this is a big worry, is in the short term, this could be really bad. And then in the long term, big picture, we could see this make an even worse turn for housing for Cape Codders.
Yeah. Also, Ethan, there's a proposal to allow hunting and conservation land in Brewster that's called Punghorn Parklands. I know hunting has a long history here in the Cape. Tell us a little bit about why hunting is being proposed there and what the reaction has been like.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with kind of, for folks who haven't been to the Punghorn, it's kind of a massive area in the south of Brewster and kind of bleeds into Harwich a little. But it's 800 plus acres. There's trails all over the place, a few ponds. It's huge with walkers, horse riders, bikers. It's kind of this nature wonderland out there in Brewster. And historically has been used for hunting before, but hasn't in decades since the town purchased it in the 80s. So a proposal came up last year to allow some, actually it was kind of general, to allow hunting in town in general, bow hunting for turkeys. That the conversation has really been focused on the Punghorn. And also a lot of people had a lot of safety concerns about allowing any kind of hunting in there. But so right now, just this week, there was a question of whether the Conservation Commission, who sets the town's hunting policy every year, if they even have the power to allow hunters to go in there. Supposedly, there may have been a vote in the 80s at either the selectman or town meeting level that banned hunting. So now it's kind of a jurisdictional question that's kind of trying to be hashed out there in Brewster.
Do we get a sense of, you know, why is this being proposed now?
So it came up last year at the request of a hunter. And then at that point, the Conservation Commission had said, okay, we're not going to make a decision yet. We're going to do a study to kind of see what the deer population is in the Punghorn. The state recently did a study and found that, according to them, the density of deer per square mile is higher than they would recommend, and there's some moderate impacts to the forest from deer browsing.
Okay. Now I guess going forward here, this obviously doesn't seem like a done deal. Any public meetings coming up where people can maybe voice some of their concerns?
Yeah, absolutely. Concerns, obviously a lot of hunters are in favor of this. The CONCOM is expected to take this up again in its next meeting. I don't think a date has been officially set for that. But they did kind of shoot a message over to Town Hall and the select board to see if they have any idea on jurisdictional or in general just comments.
Okay. So still a lot to be learned here. It's Ethan Ganter from the Cape Cod Times. Thanks for joining us, Ethan.
Thank you, Sam.
We turn now to the election. Early in-person voting started on Saturday for the 2020 presidential election. and we have not been let down so far. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us now. Good morning, Jeanette.
Morning, Sam.
Jeanette, local town clerks say the turnout has been high for early voting. In some cases, they've had voters line up outside the door. What's happening there?
Yes, well, the town clerk in Barnstable, Ann Quirk, says they have had lines stretching outside, and she's hearing similar stories from other towns on the Cape. The clerks kind of talk in the late afternoon, she says, a lot, compare stories. Part of those lines and that situation is because of the high interest in the election, but part of it is also because of the COVID-19 restrictions. So in Barnstable, for example, each polling place is going to have only 6 voting booths, whereas they normally have 15 at each polling place. So it can take a little bit longer to get through. She said one day this week, Barnstable actually had more than 800 people vote early, and that's just at the one location used for early voting. So there could be lines, but she did say people are kind of happy to vote, and they're keeping a positive attitude about the whole thing so far.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. I actually voted in Falmouth this week, and I waited about 15 minutes, but not too bad. I understand also, this is kind of interesting, voter registration is really up as well. Is that the case in Barnstable?
Yes, she said just since the primary, they've had more than 1,200 additional voters register in Barnstable. So between the registrations, the mail-in ballots, and everything else, she says it is kind of hard to keep up. It's definitely their busy season. But she says she has between 20 and 30 volunteers working, as well as the staff, all helping out.
Wow. Okay. Also, Jeanette, earlier this week, you reported on new developments on the panel that's overseeing the decommission of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. It sounds like some people on the panel aren't really happy with how voting rules take place.
Yes, this was interesting. So the law that created this panel, which is called the Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel, the law requires them to have a majority vote of the full membership of this group, no matter how many people actually show up to a meeting. And it's a big group. There's 21 members. Sometimes they have seats that are vacant, but those seats still count toward this sort of vote count majority that they need. There are also a fair number of people on the panel who are state employees representing various agencies, and it seems like they sometimes abstain from votes. The panel also has 2 voting members who represent the plant itself, Pilgrim, and the owner, Holtec. So for a variety of reasons, they do tend to have a fair number of abstentions. And some members are saying it's hard to get anything done. There were at the meeting where they discussed this, there had been previously, there were 2 motions that failed. Each of those had 6 abstentions each. So One of the members, Sean Mullen, made a motion to ask the state to change that rule so they can approve something just with the majority of people who actually are present at the meeting.
Right.
And that passed. Yeah, that passed, I think, surprisingly to some people, considering so many things were failing. That actually passed with a minimum 11 votes to pass something.
Okay.
But again, that's just like a request. They don't have the power to make that change themselves.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. This is just a recommendation. Yeah, who does have the power to make that change?
Well, those rules are in the law that created the group, the panel. So they're asking the legislature for a bill, but it would have to be voted and signed into law to make that change.
Okay.
I believe.
Interesting. Okay. So what is the panel actually working on right now?
Well, Holtec just submitted its site assessment to the state, and that's a document that outlines how they'll demonstrate that they're complying with cleanup standards as the decommissioning process goes forward, and also what kinds of contaminants will be monitored on that land into the future. The state has some time to comment on that document, and then the citizens panel is going to be reviewing it, I believe, at their next meeting.
Okay, and that's CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thanks for joining us, Jeanette.
Thanks, Sam.
We're turning to the Vineyard and the Tisbury School. It's been over a year since there were reports of air quality problems at the school. This week, we get a picture of what renovations at the school could look like, and we're joined now by news editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sam.
So, George, tell us what the school could look like if these plans do go forward. I mean, they seem like a pretty substantial upgrade.
Oh, yeah. They're spending $53.2 million is the estimate, so there ought to be a pretty good upgrade. They're looking to add on a significantly larger gymnasium. They're looking to add on a wing where the administration would be, and that will open up classrooms within the building where they can better meet the needs of students in the school. This has been a long process. As listeners probably know, a couple of years ago, there was a new school proposed for $46.6 million, and that had $14 million of state aid that would have reduced the price. In this case, they're looking at a renovation and addition project to preserve this building, and at this point, doing it all on their own with taxpayer money. So no additional money has been found for it at this point in grants or state aid. And officials got their, you know, some of the other officials like selectmen and the finance committee and got their first look at this week. They were pretty excited about what they saw in terms of, you know, how this will meet the educational needs of the students and what it looks like. They like what they're getting for that money. But there are some concerns about where to put students while the renovation and addition goes on, should this be approved.
Right.
One possibility.
Yeah, I heard it might take about 2 years to build. I mean, what are you going to do with students for those 2 years?
Yeah, it just so happens that there's a business nearby, Educomp, that is going out of business. That's a pretty good sized building, not far from where Tisbury School is. And it backs up to a significant town park, Veterans Memorial Park. So what they're talking about is putting a bid in on that building and then having some modular classrooms on the parkland behind it. I mean, this is all very preliminary, and but they're trying to ease the fear of parents. These Tisbury School students, you started off by saying the air quality problems last year. These students were split up for a significant amount of time last year, then were reunited, and then went to, online learning. So they've had a rough go, the kids that have been there the last couple of years. So they don't want a lot of big disruptions. So it seems like a pretty good idea, a way to accomplish this. But again, it's all pretty preliminary at this point.
Okay. Also, George, this has been a kind of a delicate debate in many towns, whether to go old school with grass athletic fields, you know, where I played, or artificial turf, which, you know, environmentalists are uneasy with the idea of artificial turf. Still, you hear a lot of praise from athletes. How are the schools on the Vineyard treating this? And, you know, what's in the works so far?
So there's a proposal before the Martha's Vineyard Commission to put in a synthetic field at the high school, and it went before the Land Use Planning Committee this week. It was just an initial review to hear what the plans are and to kind of give some feedback. One of the biggest things here is recycling. It's a big issue on the island already. Here we have an island that has, by and large, banned plastic bottles of a certain size, and yet they want to bring in a synthetic field. So people are naturally saying, how are we going to recycle this? There isn't a plan at this point. There is no place to recycle it. We've done a lot of reporting on this. Lucas Doris has looked into it extensively. There is no place in the United States to do this at this point, despite the in the actual proposal from school officials saying that it will be recycled when it's at its end of life, which is about 10 years. So it's hotly debated, to be sure, and it's going to get even more hotly contested as this approaches the public hearing before the commission.
Okay. And is there a sense of urgency here? I mean, I guess the question is, what's the shape of the current fields and when could we see these plans going forward?
Yeah, that's a good point. The track at the high school a couple of years ago was condemned, and they have done some temporary repairs to that to bring it back to life. But I mean, that's a shame for a couple of years. The high school kids couldn't even compete on their own track, but they can right now. And so the fields are in really rough shape. If you were to go there now and take a look, you know, there are pits and bare spots, and it's hard to maintain grass in New England, as anybody who's ever tried knows, especially fields that are used a lot. And these fields are used a lot by the high school and by other communities on the island for their youth sports. So there's a lot of wear and tear.
Yeah. I mean, do we get a sense, this proposal came to them recently, I guess. Any sense of a timeline on when it could go forward?
It's got to get approved first, and that's something that it's before the commission. And you know, we've heard that it's going to be privately financed, but we haven't heard a lot of details about that private financing. And there are some questions being raised about that on the island as well. People would like a little bit more detail. How are we going to pay for this, and how are we going to pay to maintain it? Because if we're having trouble maintaining grass fields, you know, it seems like a synthetic field would be easy to have upkeep on, but it's not, you know, it does need maintenance just like any other piece of equipment that any school has, so, or facility that they have. So that's something that's being questioned as well.
And then there's the cost of recycling it
Absolutely. And replacing it.
Right. That's George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks for joining us, George.
Thanks, Sam. Enjoyed it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. There's a possibility that an old Coast Guard boathouse might be returning home to Chatham. It's moved around quite a bit, but it has a history with the town, including ties to some daring rescues. We're joined now by Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Sam.
Tim, this boathouse dates back to the 1930s in Chatham. It's pretty neat. Where is it now? And tell us, a little bit about the history here.
Sure. Well, right now the boathouse is sitting on the shore of a marina in Hull. And how it got there is an interesting story. As you said, it was built in the 30s on the shores of Stage Island in Chatham, which is on Stage Harbor. It was built by the Coast Guard, and its claim to fame really is that the CG-36500 motor lifeboat, which was used in the 1952 rescue of the crew of the tanker Pendleton, which we all saw in the movie The Finest Hours, that was its home. That the boathouse was where it was kept for many years. But in the 1970s, the boathouse was decommissioned. At the time, the town was offered the opportunity to buy the boathouse and the small slice of property that it stood on for a dollar. But town officials passed. Fast forward several decades to 2009, and the owner of that property wanted to build a house. And the boathouse had fallen into sort of disrepair, and the person wanted to demolish it. Grassroots movement in town of folks worked to try to find a new location for it, but unfortunately they failed. But Boston contractor Jay Cashman stepped in, and he is a part-time resident of Chatham, and he barged the boatyard to his the boathouse to his boatyard in Quincy. He had some ideas for using it. None of those came to fruition, and he ended up giving it to the owner of this marine yard in Hull. But that process ran into problems with permits from the town of Hull, and so the owner decided that he was going to include it in an auction that was coming up and supposed to be held yesterday. When word of this got back to some of those folks in town who had originally been involved in trying to find a home for it, they talked to the owner and got him to take it out of the auction. And they had a gentleman's agreement with him to buy the boathouse and bring it back to Chatham.
Huh. That's
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a venture. Is there a plan now with, you know, how they're going to bring it back to Chatham? I imagine there's some complications and expenses transporting, you know, what's an historic, you know, boathouse several miles.
Sure. Yeah, that's going to be a challenge. That they have two challenges, really, is to figure out how to get it back to Chatham. When Cashman took it up to Quincy, it cost about $250,000 to do that process. So they've got some fundraising in their future. And then they have to figure out where it's going to go. And there's been talk about sort of keeping it in the Stage Harbor complex. One possibility is the town has been looking at building a new shellfish upwelling facility on Stage Harbor. And the thought is maybe this building, which is about the same size as the proposed building, could be that upweller. You know, there's a lot of people in town that are still smarting over the fact that the original 36500 boat ended up in the hands of the Orleans Historical Society through a bunch of different mechanizations, and people kind of want to get this boathouse back to Chatham and sort of save it as part of the history of the town.
Yeah, right. I mean, right. Chatham has a history with the Coast Guard and marine life for sure. Also in the news, Tim, a Chatham resident recently won an Emmy Award for technology he came up with half a century ago. Tell us about the invention and why he's being honored now.
Sure. We're talking about Michael Thompson, who is an engineer. He was working for Bell Labs in the 1970s. When, you know, basically he invented digital photography. He invented he came up with the process and applied this type of computer chip to imaging. And he took the first digital photo, which was a picture of his wife, actually, that ended up on the cover of Electronics magazine in January 1973. He has a number of other inventions to his name as well, including thermal imaging, and he invented a way to convert analog signals to digital, and he did a lot of work with television tubes and trying to reduce their size, and that and his digital imaging work prompted him to receive a Technology and Engineering Achievement Emmy from the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. This was awarded, actually announced earlier this year, but it was awarded to him virtually just the other day. You know, the irony of that wasn't lost on him, that you know, getting an award for digital imaging over a Zoom or whatever process they used is kind of interesting. But it's a nice recognition for this local resident, and he's received a number of accolades over the years, but this one's kind of fun.
Yeah, that is pretty neat. That's Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks for joining us, Tim.
Thanks, Sam. Take care.
Switching gears here, the pandemic will undoubtedly have long-term consequences here locally, and we saw a sign of some implications with the Steamship Authority this week. It looks like the Board of Governors is ready to pull the switch on rate hikes across the board. And joining us now to help us understand this is Noah Asimo. He's a reporter with the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Sam.
Noah, give us a sense here. What can passengers expect in the coming year in terms of these increases?
So basically what we're looking at, and this is sort of the area that it's going to hit hardest, is going to be on peak summer vehicle pricing. On the Vineyard route, at least, there's going to be a $15 one-way peak summer vehicle increase, and that basically means any vehicle traveling between Woods Hole and the Vineyard on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday of the main summer months.
Okay.
So that's a $30 round-trip increase. And then there's going to be a $4 to $6 increase on regular vehicle fares. I think there's a certain period of the year when, you know, it'll be $4 or $6, and then a $2 to $4 increase on excursion vehicle fares. Excursion vehicle fares are for people who start from the island and have island addresses. And then travel book prices are going to go up, parking fees are going to go up, and actually there's going to be a $1 increase on passenger fares. And that's the first time, I think, in 6 years that there's going to be a passenger fare increase. You know, $1 doesn't sound like much, but passenger fares are $8 one way to begin.
Right.
So,
yeah, over the years, it adds up.
More than 10% increase. Right.
Well, Ethan, I remember back in April and May, traffic on the ferries, you know, really dropped. The board was projecting kind of a massive deficit. I think one time it was even saying it was hemorrhaging $1 million a week. Is that kind of the explanation? Is that how we're getting to where we are?
Well, the backstory on it is sort of interesting. You're right that back when the pandemic began in March and April, the boat line was hemorrhaging money. It was a little bit less than $1 million a week, but still a very significant amount. Traffic has since picked up significantly. They were projecting what was looking like, you know, I mean, they were sort of throwing numbers around, but they were looking at a $50 million to $60 million deficit back in March or back in April. And now that number is looking like it's going to be more around the $10 million to $12 million range. And actually, at the meeting this past Tuesday, Bob Davis, who's the Steamship Authority's general manager, was saying, hey, we actually might not even need a state bailout with regard to our budget because they've gotten a pretty significant amount of federal CARES Act money. So if it ends up being small enough, then they might be in fairly good shape. But the way they're planning ahead is by predicting that passenger traffic at the minimum is going to be less than it is during normal years. That sort of plays out in how traffic has proceeded into the fall. Vehicle traffic is pretty much at 100% of its regular values, whereas passenger traffic is sort of sitting at 85%. And so what they're planning for the next year, at least the next fiscal year, is that there's going to be approximately 90% of normal traffic on the passenger side and then about 100% of normal traffic on the vehicle side. And that's what those fare increases are basically supposed to cover.
Okay. Give me a sense of the Board of Governors. They kind of set the budget for the steamship, and they met this week. What are their thoughts on these rate hikes? I mean, is it avoidable or can the public chime in here?
Well, they kind of, you know, I think their stance on it was sort of this sucks. It's a shrug. I think they called it a bitter pill, but they're sort of swallowing it anyway. I think they get where it's coming from. I mean, the thing about it, I think, that is difficult for a lot of islanders, both on Nantucket and the Vineyard, and actually, for the record, Nantucket's rate hikes are slightly larger even than the Vineyard's. The thing about it is just that there were significant rate hikes last year, and those rate hikes were to cover, you know, more maintenance costs, because that was one of the recommendations in the HMS report about the steamship. Which was a consulting organization that looked at the steamship. So this is the second year in a row that there's going to be rate increases.
Right.
I mean, I think it makes sense to the board that it has to happen, and they were actually more concerned about making sure they were budgeting conservatively enough, not necessarily about whether the rate increases were necessary. I think it was clear to them that they were. And so they basically indicated that you know, it is what it is was kind of the through
right.
line.
So
the next steps on this process are come November, the steamship board is going to vote on them, and they'll vote on the budget, then they vote on the rate adjustments, which is what that's the term they use for the increases.
Does the public, I mean, can they potentially not vote it through? I mean, does the public have an opportunity to say, well, hold on a second?
Yeah, well, the public, there's going to be public forums. They haven't set a date for them yet. Normally they have them, one on the Vineyard, one in Nantucket, one, you know, in the other port communities on the mainland.
Right.
Of course, this year with COVID-19, they're going to have them on Zoom, but they haven't set them yet. So the public does have a chance to chime in, and the public does have a chance to attend all the meetings of the Steamship Authority Board and its Port Authority. And they can correspond with the steamship as well. So the public does have a chance to chime in. And no, there's no guarantee that they will sign them. But it did seem like the Board of Governors indicated that, you know, they didn't express any outright issues.
Right, right. Okay. That's reporter Noah Asimo with the Vineyard Gazette. Thanks for joining us, Noah.
Thank you. Take care.
Taking a look at some news from the State House now. The Ways and Means Committee met this week to finally start the budget process. Meanwhile, Governor Charlie Baker outlined a plan for how state officials would distribute a vaccine if and when one becomes available next year. CAI's Catherine Iden talked to State House reporter Mike Dean for an update.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
The Joint Ways and Means Committee actually started the process this week with a look at the governor's proposed budget, which actually increases spending, even though the economic road ahead is pretty rocky. Remind us, we've talked about this, but remind us quickly what Baker's plan calls for.
Yeah, not only is it a spending increase over last year, it's actually a spending increase over what Baker himself proposed earlier this year in January before the pandemic set in. So it's 3.8% more than what has been spent before. And, you know, this is keeping spending for things like education and you know, local aid to cities and towns very stable. Now, it should be noted that that new funding formula for local schools is going to be delayed because of the pandemic and kind of the revenue swings that the state has been under. But there's an awful lot of federal money left over from the CARES Act and different acts of Congress that pumped billions into states over these last few months. And one sector that's actually growing this cost is mass health. That's where Baker says a lot of the cost growth is happening. Of course, that's the biggest program that Massachusetts has to pay for, health care subsidies for the poor and working people. But that's actually going to increase. And, in order to do all of this spending, you have to take from the rainy day fund a maximum of $1.35 billion from the rainy day fund. That's the state savings. And also $1.8 billion left over from all of that federal funding. So it's what we call kind of one-time funding revenue sources that the state is relying on in order to balance its budget, because that tax revenue just isn't there.
Mike, we've talked about this before. House and Senate leaders have said that they were a little wary of dipping into the rainy day fund. But now that they're into this formally, this budget process, have they changed their minds at all about dipping into that fund?
Well, the talk from Democrats who are really in charge of the budget in the legislature was all about services and, what government is for and what government needs to do. So I would say, based on that hearing this week, there might be a willingness to go even further with spending that money. That could mean, dipping in even further into the state savings instead of spending over a third of the rainy day fund. Or alternatively, that could mean raising specific taxes. I don't think there's any willingness or any stomach to do a broad-based tax. However, there is still talk about the gas tax. That's something the House Democrats passed earlier in the year before the pandemic. Certain corporate taxes and different loophole closings and things like that. So they may want to look at where they can get revenue, because they are dedicated to maintaining this level of funding.
But the governor has said that he is not in favor of any tax hikes, right? So what might happen if the House and the Senate think that those are imperative?
Yeah, so that's one kind of a sticky thing. However, if you look at the governor's proposal, he has new taxes in it. So there are tax proposals that he's already proposed in his health care bill from last year that would create a 15% excise tax on opioids and add new penalties to drug manufacturers when they hike their prices kind of exorbitantly. Lawmakers didn't take up that bill. They more or less rejected the idea when the governor filed it. So I don't know if it's going to get any more progress now that it's baked into Baker's budget proposal. But if not, it means that those Democrats need to look elsewhere for those dollars if they don't want to add that new opioid tax.
What is the timeline now that the budget process is formally underway? And a reminder, we're already in this fiscal year that we're talking about a budget for. So will we see a new budget anytime soon?
So we've been waiting for this thing since, April or March even, which is when they initially delayed it. Now, Baker says he wants the budget passed by both chambers of the legislature and back on his desk by Thanksgiving. So that's about a month away. That's a pretty tight turnaround for the legislature. They don't really do much in a month. Now that we've had that Ways and Means hearing, the House will come up with their own plan. They will vote on that through an amendment process to have what the House's priorities are. The Senate will then do the same, And then they have to finalize an agreement between the two of them, which is much easier said than done. The House and Senate have agreed on virtually nothing this year. So getting a deal done between Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate is one thing, and then back to the Republican governor by Thanksgiving is another.
Governor Charlie Baker also outlined this week how the state would approach administering a COVID-19 vaccine once it becomes available. This is, you know, months out from happening, but he, I'm guessing, wants people to feel comfortable that they're thinking about it.
When Baker laid out this plan, he said that anything that gets federal approval is then going to be scrutinized by local authorities. So he was really indicating that as soon as something is made available, he would have his own people kind of look at and evaluate it. Of course, Massachusetts has the medical resources to do that kind of thing, but it certainly indicated that he wouldn't necessarily just trust what was coming from the federal approval process. When this gets distributed, is it first going to go to those frontline workers that we try to prevent from getting sick, who are dealing with patients that have COVID-19, and then, you know, medically vulnerable people, those over 64 years old, or those who have pre-existing conditions that could make them very vulnerable. So it's going to be a multi-phase distribution plan. So we'll learn more about that when it gets going. But I think that, you know, as Baker stated, he expects very, very limited supplies of a vaccine when it's first released.
All right. Managing expectations for people. That is State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us, as he does most weeks. Mike, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Sam Houghton. Hey, toxic green algae is growing in ponds all across the region. CAI's climate and environment reporter Eve Zukoff produced a three-part series this week about how cyanobacteria are growing, who they are hurting, and why the problem seems to be getting worse. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Sam. Thank you.
So, Eve, tell us a little bit more about these cyanobacteria. You know, what do they look like in our ponds, and how are they getting there?
Yeah, so cyanobacteria are actually a natural part of a healthy aquatic ecosystem. They're natural, they're normal, but it's warm temperatures related to climate change and nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus that seep out of our septic systems that really act like fuel for cyanobacteria. And with that fuel, they're able to multiply really, really quickly, and they form these kind of massive mats on top of ponds, and as they break down, they can become really toxic. In terms of their appearance, sometimes you actually can't see any sign of a toxic bloom at all, but often on the Cape in ponds, they kind of make the water look bright green. There's often kind of mats and algae that kind of come up to the shoreline. They're pretty gnarly looking.
You report on a man who was exposed to a bloom on Martha's Vineyard, and he became pretty ill. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so I spoke with a man named Michael Forgione, who went crabbing one evening on Chilmark Pond this summer. And so basically he was wading just barely up to his knees, a big guy too, you know, very tall, you know, sturdy guy. And he said within an hour he just feel right. So he started getting really tired and disoriented. He laid down in a dinghy to take a nap. And when he finally got up to drive himself home, he made it to his mother's porch where he could not stand up. He was agitated. He was swollen all throughout his hands, feet, and lower legs. And his mother told me he couldn't put weight on his feet. She's a longtime nurse practitioner. And then about a week, he said he started to recover, but to this day, he still experiences intermittent numbness and neurological symptoms. And sure enough, a few days later, a toxic bloom was discovered in the pond. And while his symptoms are a little bit unusual, many people can experience anything from skin rashes to gastrointestinal issues to major organ damage. We just don't know enough about how different people respond to exposure to different cyanotoxins. So what he experienced is really scary. It's a really big wake-up call to a lot of local public officials.
Wow. Yeah, that is scary. Give us a sense of, you know, who is in charge of monitoring these blooms.
Yeah, I wish it was a more simple question. Right now, the state doesn't require that towns monitor for blooms. And our state doesn't monitor for blooms. So there's this kind of patchwork quilt of solutions that emerges where some towns go ahead and monitor proactively. And on the Cape, that mostly means paying anywhere from $3,000 to $7,000 a year to the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, which goes in every 2 weeks through the kind of spring, summer, early fall to monitor ponds. And that actually works largely, though it's worth noting that challenges remain when it comes to actually notifying the public of toxic blooms, you know, getting signs up when there are many people who access ponds from private residences. But that's kind of the best case scenario right now.
Yeah, okay. And when a town, you know, doesn't monitor for blooms, what happens?
Well, it's a little bit of a black box. But we know that there are towns on the Cape that don't regularly or proactively monitor. Same thing on Martha's Vineyard. So they essentially, town health agents essentially wait for a complaint to come in. And to be fair to town health agents, this is because they're also in charge of restaurant inspections and triple response and the coronavirus. You know, throw that one in there. But then that means that it's only once there are already signs of a potentially toxic bloom that towns start to act. And what they do is they can turn to the state to come in, collect a water sample, send it to a private lab, process that sample, which is incredibly expensive to the state. It can cost up to $600 to test a single water sample. But then we're talking about so many steps from when a bloom is first noticed, I mean, to the public actually being notified, that it can take up to 12 days. And in that time, you have children swimming, you have dogs drinking the water, you have a lot of it's a big exposure window, the way the current system works.
Yeah, that's interesting. So did you come across any potential solutions here?
Yeah, this one depends on who you ask. But what's interesting about cyanobacteria blooms is that this is an entirely solvable problem. I mean, they're when it comes to climate change, limiting global warming is a big challenge, and it's one that affects so many things, and that's a hard one. But it really comes down to the source. So, you know, I think there are people who say, first of all, you can improve monitoring by building out a county-wide system. The county already monitors for fecal bacteria like E. coli. They need more money and more time to be able to monitor for cyanobacteria. Or the state could beef up their financial contribution to private groups like APCC to support town health agents. And then, of course, there are those who say the solution isn't monitoring at all. The solution is reducing what fuels the blooms, really and truly moving away from, you know, the fact that 80% of the Cape relies on septic systems, and septic systems are these kind of antiquated wastewater systems that allow nitrogen to seep out. We have to further the push towards, sewering the Cape and looking for nitrogen-reducing septic systems, these kind of new innovative systems that are being developed right here on the Cape. And if we don't get there, we could lose these ponds.
Yeah. That's Eve Zuckoff, environmental reporter here at CAI. Thanks for joining us, Eve.
Thank you, Sam.
You can catch Eve's three-part series on our website at capeandislands.org. That's it for today's show. A big thanks to my guests, Ethan Genter with the Cape Cod Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, George Brennan with the Martha's Vineyard Times, CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, and Noah Asma with the Vineyard Gazette. Also, a big thanks to Dan Tridle holding it down socially distance and back at the studio. I'm Sam Houghton. Join us next week for another edition of CAI's Local News Roundup here on The Point.